This is OPB News. I'm Christian Foden-Vansel. A boisterous crowd of cycling advocates and city leaders crammed into the bike gallery in downtown Portland yesterday. The cause for celebration? Portland's bike-friendly rating has jumped from gold to platinum. Andrew Thien explains.
The League of American Bicyclists compiles a list of bike-friendly communities across the country based on the five E's: engineering, education, encouragement, enforcement, and evaluation. Portland is the only major city to earn a platinum ranking. Andy Clark is the executive director of the League of American Bicyclists. He says there are many reasons Portland improved its ranking from the last time it applied in 2005. One reason, raw numbers.
There's been a 144% increase in the amount of bicyclists getting to work in the morning for work since 2000, and that's a huge increase.
Those numbers Clark refers to are really just the diehards, the riders who only bike to work and don't piggyback on public transit along the way. But more importantly, Clark says bike culture is permeating Portland. Portland Transportation Commissioner Sam Adams, who's running for mayor, has been pushing to achieve platinum status for years. But Adams and Bicycle Transportation Alliance leader Scott Bricker said the community can't stop now. Bricker says ideally the city wants to add 50 to 100 miles of new bike trails and boulevards in the next 5 years.
We have accomplished in Portland a tremendous amount in the 18 years that bicycling has really turned to be a focus of this city. And we are still trying to catch the next big wave. I think currently we're at base camp. We're at base platinum.
Corvallis achieved a gold ranking and Eugene silver. Commissioner Adams says the recognition means Portland can now be compared to international biking communities. Andy Clark with the League of American Bicyclists agreed. He said although much work remains to be done, Portland is now clipping at the heels of cycling meccas like Copenhagen and Amsterdam. Andrew Thien, OPB News.
Portland City Commissioner Sam Adams has no trouble distinguishing himself from his rival for the top job in Portland, Joe DiZono. Perhaps nowhere is that fact more obvious than at a wacky campaign event known as Candidates Gone Wild.
Running for mayor? He's independent-minded, progressive, he's your workaholic, Mr. Sam Adams! He's a master snacker, he's a wise humanitarian, and though he's rhythm impaired, he's the best kisser in town. It's Show DiZono!
But style aside, what is it that each candidate wants to do as one of the most powerful elected officials in Oregon? Rob Manning went looking for the answers.
Mayoral candidate Sam Adams is the current transportation commissioner, and that means when he brings a few dozen city employees and local bike activists to an afternoon press conference, he's doing his job, even if he's also running for office. Last week, Adams emphasized that as transportation commissioner, his top priority has been traffic safety.
That's where we have focused any additional money that we've received is on the places and the streets and the corridors in the city that are killing and injuring people. It is that simple in terms of what we have done.
Arguing for safer streets is also a pretty safe political bet. Adams has lobbied for spending $5.5 million to move a bridge from Sovey Island to help bikers and pedestrians cross I-405 downtown.
This project is going to save lives. The Flanders Street crossing is going to provide the greatest value in providing for the crossing that we need.
I do believe it's a misspent priority.
That's Adams' mayoral rival, Show DiZono, speaking at a City Club of Portland debate.
If we had all the money in the world, that may be a good thing to do. Not this time, not now.
But speaking on OPB's Think Out Loud, DiZono was far less definitive when asked whether he would reject the proposal outright.
So I would like to do a little more study to see what the facts are. Before I would vote on it.
This isn't the first time that Show DiZono has appeared unclear about his policy positions, but that may be changing. Standing at the corner of Southeast 82nd Avenue in Powell, DiZono says he wants to continue to champion the needs of Eastsiders, just like the current mayor, Tom Potter. And now DiZono says he's ready to present his first 100 days with those East Portlanders in mind. For example, DiZono would stop a multi-million-dollar plan to rework two major downtown streets.
I would probably advocate for a stoppage of the Burnside-Coots couplet, $80 to $100 million project that doesn't seem to be a good design, doesn't make economic sense at this time.
Tizono's other early priorities are fairly low-key, like holding a citywide education summit with Portland's half-dozen school districts. He also wants to meet with businesses that have left the city in hopes of luring them back. Adams, on the other hand, has advocated tackling the city's biggest problems, including the massive backlog of poorly maintained roads. But Adams says Portland's biggest problem isn't a city problem at all. It's the high dropout rate in Portland schools. At a debate on KGW, Adams advocated raising money to put low-income students through college.
Based on a successful effort in Kalamazoo, Michigan, I propose that we have an education endowment that good students from poor families can feel hope that they can go on after high school if they graduate for higher skills training or college training. It's shown to work in other cities.
Back on 82nd Avenue, DiZono is skeptical of ambitious plans to rework education policy, preferring instead to talk to school leaders. He says that's one example where he thinks Adams is moving too quickly.
I do think we have clearly a different point of view about many things, and you know, I'm coming into this race late, but you know, I think my vision is about slowing down the process and making sure we have the right solution.
DiZono says mistakes sometimes come from charging ahead, and he says some of Adams' ideas, like moving the Sovie Island Bridge, are merely to benefit the commissioner's career.
You know, I think what people have observed is, you know, Sam is very quick to propose ideas and solutions, and I think he's not willing to listen to other opinions. For him, this is the vision piece.
Adams says he was hard-charging in his days as a chief of staff to former Mayor Vera Katz, but he says he's taken risks, like willingly taking on the aerial tram project after it became a political hot potato. He had his own criticism for DiZono's methodical approach at a recent debate.
When you're a mayor or the member of the city council, there's no maybe button. You've got to vote yes or no on the issue presented before you.
Style will no doubt enter the equation when Portlanders cast ballots for mayor this spring. Voters will have a choice between an outsider and businessman in DiZono versus an experienced policy wonk in Sam Adams. But there will also be the differences in policies, with Adams offering ambitious, sweeping proposals and DiZono approaching issues more cautiously. If neither candidate wins a majority of votes on May 20th, Portlanders are bound to hear a lot more of these debates over the summer. Rob Manning, OPB News.
New state rules take effect tomorrow for those living in migrant housing in Oregon. The requirements will raise the standard of living for workers and bring Oregon in line with tougher federal regulations. Pete Springer reports.
More than 10,000 seasonal farm workers in Oregon live in housing provided by their employers. The conditions they live in vary widely.
Extremely substandard, mildly substandard, and places where employers pay attention and provide at least the minimum required conditions, and some go above and beyond.
Shelley Latin works in Pendleton as a staff attorney for Legal Aid Services of Oregon. She represents migrant farm workers on employment issues. Latin has seen some pretty dismal farm worker housing.
An employer provided basically a campground that had some showers, and it was actually quite unsanitary. And there were hanging wires and refrigerators outdoors and standing water. And people brought their own tents to live in while they were harvesting the crop.
However, Latin emphasizes the majority of farm worker housing in Oregon is not like that. She says the most common problems are overcrowding, lack of heat, and not enough laundry and shower facilities.
So every time a worker comes home, if he or she doesn't take a shower and change their clothes right away and they walk in and they hug their new baby, there are really high probabilities of transferring some of those pesticides to their child.
And since migrant workers often only have one change of clothes, laundry and shower facilities are the best way to ensure pesticides stay out of farm worker housing. The new rules specifically address those conditions. For one thing, they increase the number of laundry and bathing facilities required, and they mandate that occupied units have heat.
Are we treating our workers fairly?
Ramon Ramirez is the president of Oregon Farm Worker Union, or PECUN.
The bottom line is that farm workers for many, many years have been basically subsidizing the American public by putting, we're the folks that pick the product, that pick the fruits and vegetables, that put it on the American table.
He points to lower life expectancies for farm workers, higher cancer rates, higher infant mortality rates, and increased miscarriages.
I mean, I think that the consuming public got to realize that farm workers are being shortchanged and that it's about time that we do something about that. And housing is just one aspect of this, but we got to do more.
Andrea Cano echoes those sentiments. She's the executive director of the Oregon Farm Worker Ministry.
It's really something that we need to bring out into the open. Maybe we need to convene a kind of a statewide summit so we bring in the stakeholders and the farm workers and the consumers, retailers, and have this a greater discussion than even just the housing.
Cano points out that while agribusiness has expanded in Oregon, farm worker housing has not. And she adds there's an anti-immigrant sentiment out there that makes it a challenge to improve substandard housing for farm workers. It's estimated that 75% of Oregon farm workers are undocumented.
If they shipped off every undocumented farm worker tomorrow, the agribusiness industry would collapse here.
Andrea Cano and Ramon Ramirez with the Farm Workers Union praise the new housing regulations, but say housing and working conditions still need a lot of improvement. And they say they're not entirely sure of the state's commitment to enforce the new rules that officially take effect May 1st. Pete Springer, OPB News.
Portland's ambitious Wi-Fi project appears stalled, with MetroFi, the company that's trying to build it, saying it doesn't have the money to finish, and the city saying MetroFi is in breach of contract. Patrick Emerson, an assistant professor at the Department of Economics at Oregon State University, has been tracking the problem on his website, the Oregon Economics blog. He believes MetroFi's business model was flawed from the start. I asked him how he could have been so sure.
Well, I think the business model was predicated on the fact that current ad revenues would pay for the fixed cost of the infrastructure build-out of the system. And ad revenues of this sort are not typically a high revenue generator.
Well, is there an economic model that could have worked? I mean, didn't businesses like Google follow a less traditional business model? And they could be said to be doing pretty well.
That's right. Google has a number of advantages. One is that they tap into a much larger customer base. And two is that they're able to target ads very well. And they can track the clicks from those ads and demonstrate how well those ads are working, how effective those ads are. And that allows them to charge a much higher rate than someone like MetroFi would be able to do.
So in your opinion, though, is there any way that MetroFi could have done it that would have worked financially?
Well, I know that in the case of Minneapolis, the wireless system there was built by a private contractor, but in that case, the city also awarded a number of city contracts for broadband internet service at the same time that allowed for a more stable and guaranteed revenue stream to enable the company to afford the fixed cost of the infrastructure build-out.
Yeah. So the city's probably spent about $250,000 trying to get MetroFi to cover the whole area with internet access. Do you think, just standing back a bit, do you think a city should be involved within providing internet access to its citizens? And if so, why?
Well, this is an interesting question. I think in some senses this is a municipal problem that is brought about by a failure of federal telecommunications policy. So people who want broadband internet access right now have really only two choices, and that is to either go to the local telephone monopoly or the local cable monopoly. And that causes these sort of bottlenecks, if you will, or very expensive broadband access available to them at home. Other countries, like France, for example, have opened up the telecommunications networks, the infrastructure networks, to competing broadband service providers, and there they have faster and cheaper broadband access. So the problem right now, I think, is that it's very hard to afford broadband access for a number of households or for a whole class of households. And a municipality like Portland, Oregon, that recognizes that broadband access is potentially quite important in order for the sort of education and welfare of its citizens, I do think has a role in trying to provide it more cheaply.
So you think it's a little like a library where we need to provide books so people can come in and read and learn and then go out and get better jobs than they perhaps would have done otherwise?
Yeah, in economics the idea is that there's a social return to these kinds of investments. So it's the same reason why we publicly invest in schools, is that education not only helps those people who go to school, but it also helps all those around. So having well-educated, high-productivity people is good for the economy of Portland, good for the economy of Oregon, and good for everybody who participates.
So in your opinion, what should Portland do now?
So I think Portland has a number of options right now. I think one thing that municipalities can do more effectively than small private companies like MetroFi is raise capital and at a much cheaper rate through the issuance of municipal bonds. So they could, for example, fund the rest of the build-out. And it is my understanding, by the way, that the ad revenue that MetroFi is currently getting from this very small network is sustaining the actual day-to-day operating costs of the network. So it does appear that once the infrastructure is there, that the business model will work. So that's one thing that the city might consider doing.
And, of course, one of the things that the city wanted to do was be able to communicate amongst its own departments using that Wi-Fi access, which it can't do now, but would be able to do if the whole thing was built out.
That's right. And the funds that they provide to MetroFi don't have to be a grant. They can be a loan, and they can ask that MetroFi service the debt from these municipal bonds as well. I think that might be an effective way to solve the problem.
All right. Well, thanks very much.
It's my pleasure.
Patrick Emerson has been tracking MetroFi's effort to create a Wi-Fi cloud in Portland. He's an assistant professor of economics at Oregon State University.